The Stephen King Immersion Phenomenon by Kevin Quigley. Kevin Quigley is a novelist and Stephen King monographer whose books Chart of Darkness, A Good Story in Good Words, and the Illustrated Stephen King Movie Trivia Guide, co-written with Brian Freeman and Hans Akilila, explore the untapped or lesser-known avenues of Stephen King's vast universe. Kevin also runs Charnel House, one of the longest-running Stephen King websites on the internet, focusing on full-length book reviews and up-to-date news. Kevin is a graphic designer in Boston, where he lives with his husband, Sean. In the far-flung past of the mid-1980s, Stephen King expert Dr. Michael Collings wrote an essay on King's then-newest novel, It, titled A Concatenation of Monsters. The essay does a deep dive into what makes It work, exploring the unusual crossroads of the mythic and historic, of narrative fiction merged with loose autobiography and more. After pulling back the critical veil and admitting how much the novel moved him, Collings calls It King's comprehensive masterpiece, and concludes that the book transcends itself to stand as the most powerful novel King has yet written. So let's talk about transcendence and the work of Stephen King. Collings's point about It is that the book stands as a masterpiece on its own. The novel is, for the most part, an objectively fantastic work. But it's the audience response, that untouchable, unquantifiable feeling the book gives the reader, that makes it transcend itself. It's more than simply being swept away by the story or being invested in the characters. It's the way so many of King's novels have of making you feel like you're part of the story, like these things are happening to you, not in some recounted past, but right now. We're in Ben Mears' raiding party in Salem's Lot. We're in those sewers in the Losers Club in It. We're working the midway in Joyland, and we're inmates in the Dueling Correctional Facility for Women in Sleeping Beauties. It manages to pull off the near impossible, firmly inserting us into the Losers Club in 1958 and then bringing us back into the circle in 1985, ready to grow young again. The book's multiple concurrent finales across two timelines and several locales serve as the epitome of that transcendence. You're not reading the work so much as absorbing it, the words sometimes actually getting in the way of your experience. While It might be one of the best examples of this phenomenon, it's by no means unique in King's canon. The man has a knack for this sort of thing. Witness Carrie, right at the start. It's a short book and we just barely get into the lives of these fascinating characters, but the scenes in which Carrie uses her telekinesis seem to drag the reader into the book, heightening and expanding the very experience of the reading. Much has been made of King's cinematic text. He uses those tools bluntly here, wielding the word flex like a stage direction, signaling to the reader that something awesome is about to happen. It's that full immersion in the text, that sense that the book is pulling you along for the ride. Reading itself is secondary to the experience of being in the book, as though the spaces between the words are themselves telekinetic. Over the next few years, it's psi phenomena that King would go to most readily to achieve this magnetic momentum. See Danny's clairvoyant flashes in The Shining, Charlie McGee's pyrokinetic events in Firestarter, or Johnny Smith's psychic episodes in The Dead Zone. There's a particular heat of friction that comes through in these sequences. It's not just moments of excitement or horror, either. There are two moments in The Dead Zone, when Johnny is holding Denny, the baby, and when he touches old wood and gets sepia-toned memories of the long past that emerge quietly out of the narrative that also retain this unusual feel of transcendence. It's not telling, it's not showing. Despite the fact that these moments center on supernatural elements, these sequences feel like breathing, like autonomic responses inside the reader that King simply spelunked into consciousness. Beyond psi abilities and King's unique touch describing them, witness his evolving take on romantic love. King mastered the art of characters falling in love early on. Sue and Tommy and Carrie are in love before the book begins, and despite Sue's reservations, theirs seems a most healthy, happy young relationship. King uses these relationships as a springboard for drama. Larry and Lucy in The Stand, Arnie and Lee in Christine, even Johnny and Sarah in The Dead Zone. Not until the fourth book of the Dark Tower series does the romantic relationship become the point of the story. Amidst all the talk of Thinnies and Harriers and the Crimson King, Roland and Susan's young relationship takes center stage, emerging as Stephen King's only real stab at the romance genre, despite snippets and misery. The moments this pair are together generate the same sort of frisson that the psi occurrences in King's earlier books did. Incongruously, Roland and Susan's relationship is both remarkably real against the epic myth-making backdrop and elevated into something like myth itself. If the Mohane is the apotheosis of all deserts, then Roland and Susan's love affair is the apotheosis of clandestine relationships. Upon each meeting, there's that same pull, the sense that the words are getting in the way of experiencing the story as it unfolds. It's so immersive, it almost feels like voyeurism. Despite Roland and Susan's tragic end, it's the sheer joy and thrill of their togetherness that makes us one with the story. Though Stephen King is primarily known as a horror writer, this utilization of joy as a story element is one of the most vital in his toolbox. Witness Rose McClendon's first look around her own apartment in Rose Matter. King stops the momentum of the book to focus on this seemingly simple moment. In doing so, he elevates the moment to something that functions on a different level than both the violent drama of the beginning of the novel and the magical realism that comprises the latter half. It's a tricky take, because to treat it like something outsized would overwhelm its fragility. To sweep by it would be to ignore its essential power. Through his understanding of the character and her circumstance, King is able to place the reader in that apartment with her, an unseen, empathetic guest exploring Rosie's first genuine moment of self since the beginning of the book. On a subtler scale, we can turn to Dev Jones in Joyland. The book's ostensible A-story is that of the ghost haunting Joyland's horror house, and of the killer who might still prowl Joyland's grounds. The B-story, however, is at times the more engaging of the two. The story of Dev Jones getting over his breakup and learning to be his own person again. It's a bit of a pale echo to Rosie McClendon's more intense tale of escaping systematic abuse at the hands of her psychopath husband. But because Joyland is a gentle book with occasional crescendos of action and emotion, Dev's story feels just as vital and just as electric. The short novel revolves on the hinge of Dev wearing the fur, putting on the Howie the Happy Hound costume, and entertaining children at the park. The parallels to Rose Matter again assert themselves. Here again, it's simple joy driving those moments of transcendence. Dev's happiness in wearing the costume supersedes all other worry and thought, just as Rosie standing in her own apartment had done. The plot and or situation might be how we describe King's books to people, and the incredibly well-drawn characters are how we identify with the narrative. But these moments are why we keep coming back for more, not just to new stories, but to revisiting the old ones. We could examine each novel individually and single out these moments of elevation, of transcendence. Every time Edgar Fremantle paints a picture in Duma Key, we feel it. Every time Bobby Anderson reveals a new power or new gadget in the Tommyknockers, we feel it. Every time Pete Riley gets dragged into another game of Hearts in Hearts in Atlantis, we feel it. Maybe their actions don't line up with our lives, but the feelings they evoke. Like Bob Dylan wrote in Tangled Up in Blue, they flow off the page as if they're already written on our souls. These are good moments and bad, thrilling moments and quiet. These are the moments that are already in our psyches and hearts and lives, just waiting for some talented scrivener to bring them out in the open and to share them with the world. All we can do is race to read faster, to keep up with what's already there.